Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Todd Morris, registration number 36421. And may it please the court. Essentially, what we have is an argument over whether or not jury instructions 16 and 17 should have been submitted to the jury on the issue of breach of fiduciary duty. It's the defendant's claim that they shouldn't have been, as they were merely duplicative of the first claim of the complaint for negligence without offering any additional facts or any additional behaviors to sustain a claim for breach of fiduciary duty.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Mr. Morrison. I understand that this is very early in your argument, but I want to express a concern to you. And Ms. Secor, I will have the same question for you. My concern is we don't have much of a record in this case. For example, we don't have the trial testimony. And I don't know how we can resolve your argument about the instructions that the proof was duplicative without the trial testimony. And if that's so, the law tells us that we have to presume the correctness of the judgment. If you'd begin by addressing my concern, I'd appreciate that.
Certainly, Your Honor. I think just as a matter of law, you can see the standards for a claim of negligence and a claim of breach of fiduciary duty are quite different. In addition to the basic elements of negligence, breach of fiduciary duty also requires that they prove some type of an intentional tort, breach of duty of care versus standard or breach of duty. In addition, you have some type of an intentional tort, and in some manner in which, in this case, the attorney committing it was able to benefit from that. Now, none of that's found or alleged in the initial complaint.
But at the time, and again, pardon me for interrupting, but at the time that this particular objection is raised, it's at the end of the trial. And it's to the instructions. And so we would have to look at the testimony. And I agree with you that the elements are different. But we'd have to look at the testimony at the trial to resolve this issue, and we don't have that. Tell me why I'm not right about that.
I get, just to follow up, because it relates to the same issue, I guess the problem is, in looking at the complaint, that might be appropriate if we were looking at a ruling on a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, but we're not. We're looking at a ruling that is based upon what happened at the trial, and we just don't know what happened at the trial.
Well, I think it really, regardless of what happened at the trial, the jury wasn't given a set of instructions that would have ever allowed them to find the elements for a breach of fiduciary duty. It could have been proven up one side and down the other, but when they went to the actual jury forms, there wasn't a place for them to say that they had found evidence or determined that an intentional tort took place. 17 doesn't mention anything about an intentional tort. It just describes the ability to essentially transcribe information from one document to another. It doesn't say anything about the attorney's intentions while they're transcribing those bits of information from one document to another. It doesn't ask for a finding that the attorney benefited himself to the loss of the client. So regardless of what did or didn't come out in the trial, and even if testimony and evidence proving that there was a breach of fiduciary duty had come out, the fact is that the jury instruction is too deficient for the jury to have even been able to weigh out those factors as the factors weren't presented.
But unfortunately, Mr. Morse, we're again, I submit to you, we're again in kind of a tough spot about your argument because we don't have those objections preserved in front of us. We do have the part of the transcript where there's the objection to the duplicative nature of the instructions. But we don't have these two comments. We don't have any argument or rulings about that in the record before us.
If you're just referring to the argument about whether to include that particular jury instruction or not, I don't know that there was an extensive argument, the pros and cons of doing it, rather than we just had objected on the grounds that it did not put the necessary elements in front of the jurors for them to be able to weigh these factors and reach any type of determination.
Well, frankly, counsel, I read the transcript. All it says about fiduciary duty is we object to the fiduciary duty instruction, period. That's all it says. I mean, there's no reason given at all.
Correct.
I mean, see, but you're offering us a reason, but it's not a reason we can see from the record.
Well, I think what's in the record is the motion to dismiss, and we lay out the grounds fairly extensively in that document, arguing essentially the same matter that was argued before the court that we're arguing here on appeal.
I thought you were arguing on appeal in your briefs that the instructions shouldn't have been given at all, and now I hear you today saying, well, they were insufficient, which sounds to me like you're saying there should have been something additional given, in which case I wonder, wasn't it your responsibility to ask for something different?
We're actually arguing both, that they shouldn't have been given in the first place because of the duplicative nature, but if the court was to determine that they should have been given, what was given was still an incorrect statement of the law, as it didn't have any of the necessary elements for the jury to reach a conclusion one way or the other.
But what's the legal authority for your notion that there has to be what I would equate with a special interrogatory? Why can't the judge simply instruct the jury on the elements? Why isn't that sufficient? Why does there have to be, as a matter of law, a special interrogatory on whatever facts you think do or do not prove a particular claim?
Well, I think Aller is pretty clear when it points out that you simply can't make a fiduciary claim as a secondary or a backup claim or a three-year statute of limitation claim of a negligence claim because of its duplicative nature. There are separate specific facts that have to be asserted and then proven in order to maintain a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, which simply isn't done in this case. It isn't done because we're pleading the exact same transactions and occurrences, we're pleading the exact same facts in both claims, and then the jury instruction itself is just morbidly deficient on whether or not a breach of fiduciary duty did or did not occur. To the point that even if the jury had the most wonderful evidence possible in front of them that a breach of fiduciary duty occurred, they still would not be able to find those elements to check those boxes necessary on the jury form. In fact, specifically with the jury instructions themselves, jury instruction 16, pertinent part, reads that our duty was to accurately portray assets, debts, and other information to the trustee in the bankruptcy court. And then there's another sentence just excluding misinformation that the plaintiff might have provided. But even the sentence itself is a neutrally stated sentence. It's a negligence-based sentence. It doesn't state that we had to inaccurately portray for some type of a sinister reason, that the jury had to find that we had some type of a personal gain to the loss of the defendant by inaccurately reporting this information. It just says that we have a duty to accurately portray that information in a completely neutral sense without any consideration as to the intent of the attorney in question. 17 effectively puts it in action, and the pertinent parts there read, you must find that the following has been proved by preponderance of the evidence. The defendants breached their fiduciary duty to plaintiff with respect to providing information to the trustee regarding plaintiff's assets, debts, financial information in the bankruptcy matter. Again, it's simply the act of incorrectly portraying the information. Not incorrectly portraying it for a particular reason or a particular advantage to the defendants, but just simply that they were negligent in the way that that information was transcribed from one form to another. The other issue we had on appeal is there seems to be some new arguments that had come to light, or some new grounds that were being or attempted to be made, claiming that the defendants had post-original petition creation and the alleged omissions and errors that took place in its creation and filing, that the defendants then somehow hid away the fact of their error or shared secret information with the trustee in particular. We've gone through the record. I certainly can't remember this coming up and can't find it in the record either. It's our belief that it actually doesn't exist in the record for a few reasons. One, when you look at the jury instructions dealing with it, none of those elements actually appear. None of those things, the jury's not asked to find that either confidential information was or was not divulged to a third party. The jury's not asked to determine whether or not the attorney in question benefited, I'm assuming by reputation, because I haven't quite figured out what the benefit to the attorney would be by hiding that fact. But it's not asking the jury to actually make any type of determination that they had benefited from that to the detriment of the client. It's also not present anywhere in the examination or cross-examination testimony of Trustee Simon Rodriguez, who, as the reply reads, was a co-conspirator to those events. If it had happened, it would certainly be in there, but you don't find the word confidential in that testimony at all.
Pardon me again, Mr. Morse, but this returns to my original concern. We do have some testimony, but we don't have all of it. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, we don't know if there was any discussion of these sorts of things like you're talking about elsewhere in the trial. We don't know. And we are bound by the record before us.
Certainly.
And again, it's our rule that if we have an incomplete record, the missing parts are presumed to support the judgment. And particularly in a case where there is a trial and witnesses testified, if we only have part of the record, we can't say that something was or was not in the missing part. We have to presume that the missing part would support the judgment. So this goes back to my first question. Mm-hmm. How can we resolve this issue in your favor based upon the absence of the record?
I think you look at the record you do have and the parts which would be the most likely carriers of information related to these newly discovered facts. Certainly, in the testimony of Simon Rodriguez, there would be questions about whether he was given confidential information, whether he felt that the true author of the mistakes was being held from him. And if you can't find the evidence of that in the most logical places, in the places it would, by its very nature, have to appear, then it's not in the record, if it's not in the places that it would have to be, that we do have in front of us. Furthermore, the timing of the situation almost precludes it. I mean, the jury instruction itself limits itself to only the original petition, not activities that took place after the original petition was drafted and filed, making all of those alleged activities essentially a moot issue that the court doesn't necessarily have to consider, just by the time limitations found in jury instruction 16 and jury instruction 17. If I could, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Of course, you have 2 minutes and 12 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I agree with Your Honor that the record is insufficient. In fact, the appellee's brief is probably remiss in not pointing out the plethora of cases that say if the entire record is not designated, the court cannot overturn the jury's verdict because, as you stated, the court has to presume that the record that's not provided supported the jury's verdict. So anytime you're asking to overcome a jury's verdict, you have to designate the entire record. Notably, there were two experts called on behalf of Mr. Bateman. Jonathan Hagen was the designated A2B2 retained expert who found negligence and talked about the standard of care of attorneys in the situation. And Robertson Cohen was designated as an A2B2 expert who had represented the debtor in the underlying bankruptcy matter. And there was a lot of testimony there that's key to the issue of negligence in any legal malpractice case, and the testimony of the client himself that wasn't designated. And so there's plenty of testimony that supports the jury's verdict that the appellant failed to designate. And therefore, I think as a matter of law, the court has to deny the appeal because the record wasn't sufficiently provided to determine if the jury had enough or not to decide.
Ms. Secor, if I may interrupt, I think that may have the same effect as far as your cross appeal is concerned.
I'll give you that. When I initially filed the notice of appeal, I know there's a place on the record where I said, Your Honor, you're giving that instruction subject to my objection, right? And he said, right, but I did not find it. And it is, it was the last day of trial. As you can see, I tried to point out there was a substantial portion of the record that wasn't recorded at all, because we referenced having gone over jury instructions the night before and that morning, but it is not recorded. I acknowledge that. The only thing I have is that when the original jury instruction that was actually given to the jury was proposed by defendants, and in the original jury submission, Plaintiff Bateman objected to that jury instruction. And so you would have to presume that we continued to object to it, and it was given. The only possible difference in our case for that lack of record is that the jury instruction on its face is an error as a matter of law. And that's because it cites September 22nd, 2009 as the bar date. And that date should not be the bar date for the legal malpractice claim for all the reasons stated in the brief. And that I will acknowledge that objection to the written submission of the jury instruction is the only objection you have on the record before you.
Counsel, with respect to your cross appeal, I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding how the damages were different for the two claims. I know there's some explanation of it in the brief, but could you maybe clarify that?
Yes. So the legal malpractice itself was, one, giving advice that the bankruptcy petition should be filed at all, and two, the fact that they put information that had nothing to do with the debtor on the petition. Breach of fiduciary duty claim occurred afterwards. Mr. Morse said in his oral argument, in his opening, that nothing that happened post-petition applied by definition, but if you look at the jury instruction, it doesn't say that. What it says is they have a duty to accurately portray information about the debtor on the petition or otherwise. And what they did is they continued to represent to the trustee that the debtor had given them that false information when they knew that wasn't true. If you look at the closing argument, we walk through with the jury step by step what the debtor had provided to the bankruptcy attorney, Morrison Associates, on their petition, what they put on the petition itself, and then the complaint filed by the trustee, which mirrored what was put on the petition, not what the debtor had provided. And at no time did the bankruptcy attorney, who had been sued for legal malpractice, at no time did he go to the trustee and say that was our fault. And then he brought the trustee in, as the bankruptcy was ongoing while the legal malpractice claim was pending in the state court, and he brought the trustee in as a witness on their behalf. And if they had been truthful and had told the trustee that this information, we're at fault for providing this information, not the debtor, that was the breach of the fiduciary duty. That's what we argued to the jury. And we know they never did that because the trustee testified on the stand, and we do have that portion of the transcript. The trustee testified to that day, as of the day of trial, he still believed the debtor had provided the false information. But the jury knew different because we had proved what the debtor had provided to the attorney.
But my question is focusing on the damages.
Oh, I'm sorry.
How the damages differ. It sounds to me as if maybe the breach of fiduciary duty damages might be a subset of the larger damages in some way. Is that accurate?
It's possible, and the jury instruction contemplated that because it said they could not be duplicative. But since they didn't award any for statute of limitations, it's hard to tell. What we do know is they did not award what we asked for on the breach of the legal claim. The debtor had to settle that claim with the trustee for $125,000. The $111,500 judgment is almost exactly the attorney's fees that had to be paid to defend in both cases. And so it looks like that's what they gave for breach of fiduciary duty, not the damages for what occurred in the bankruptcy matter itself. For the legal malpractice claim, we had also asked for $10,000. The attorney failed to advise the client debtor that anything they paid 90 days before filing the petition could be taken back, and that was like $9,000. The jury did not award that amount either. So that was the distinction. While there was overlap, that was a distinction in the damages. With regard to the, there's really not much more to say other than that. You have the evidence on the legal malpractice claim. It will either be sufficient or it will not.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Morse.
Thank you, Your Honors. Certainly having the full record would be helpful, but I'm not so sure as just a matter of law and a de novo review that it's an absolute necessity. Regardless of what facts or could or could not have come out of a trial or could be evidenced by that testimony, the simple fact remains is that we had a jury instruction that was clearly duplicative of the first claim for negligence, and that issue would be more impacted by potential testimony that we don't have in front of us. However, once you get to the second stage, whether that jury instruction accurately reflects current law or not, we're beyond the testimony and we're beyond the record. We're into a pure de novo legal review. And as the briefs have shown, none of the elements necessary to prove a fiduciary duty are actually present. Mr. Rodriguez's testimony gets thrown around a lot. Just to clarify his, both in person and by affidavit in the record, his position was that just based on inconsistent statements from one hearing to the next alone, he had sufficient grounds to bring his adversary proceeding and everything that came after that, essentially nullifying defendant's conduct. That's been asserted here on the appellate level post original filing. If you go to the actual jury instruction number 16 and read the full text, not the abbreviated version that I have in the brief, then you'll actually see the timing characteristics that were just mentioned weren't present, namely that those jury instructions only pertain to the original petition, its preparation and its submission. Therefore, the activities that are alleged after that fact, which is what you would primarily need to rely on the missing testimony for, aren't actually material to the issue before us. On the statute of limitations, we had noticed the same thing with the difficulty in preserving the issue, that it wasn't actually on the record at any point, and we feel fairly confident that the case law supports that it doesn't require a full accounting of damages to invoke.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Ms. Secor, safe journey home. I understand it was difficult getting down here. I hope it is much easier getting back. Thank you. And Mr. Morse, safe journey to you. Bailiff shall announce the results.